Hi, I'm Tim Hernandez. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. Our guest today is the nonfiction author Stephen Church, who we'll be speaking with about his intriguing new book, One with the Tiger. It's out with Soft Skull Press. The book uses moments of violent encounters between humans and predators to explore the line between human and animal, exposing what the author defines as the, quote, shared liminal space between peace and violence. Of the book, author Benjamin Bush writes, One with the Tiger is a meditation on animality and the space between suburbs and savannah, citizenship and savagery. Stephen Church is as close to the teeth as the beast as he is to escape. This is his love letter to animal magnetism, primal fear, and the wildness of human imagination. The genius of this book is how it questions who is in captivity, the tiger in its cage or you. That is coming up right now, our discussion with author Stephen Church on Words on a Wire. Stick around. Stephen Church is the author of The Guinness Book of Me, Theoretical Killings, The Day After, The Day After, and Ultrasonic. His essays have been published and anthologized widely, including in Best American Essays and most recently in After Montaigne. Contemporary essayists cover the essays. He's a founding editor and nonfiction editor for the Normal School Literary Journal, and he teaches in the MFA program at Fresno State, where he is the Hallowell Professor of Creative Writing. Stephen Church, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Absolutely, man. I'm a fan of your books, as you already know, and especially this one, One with the Tiger, which is published by Soft Skull Press, which, you know, they do wonderful. They're a reputable publisher. Have you worked with Soft Skull before?
Yeah, I did, actually. This is my second book with Soft Skull, my second memoir, The Day After, The Day After, which came out in 2010, was also with Soft Skull. That was when they were in New York before they moved to the Bay Area, and now they're moving back to New York. So.
Wow. All these migrations happening, man.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think you were on, this is the second time you've been on our show, right? Because you were here you were interviewed by Daniel for The Day After, The Day After. Is that right?
Yeah, cool. That's right.
So you're an old pro by now on Words on a Wire.
Yeah,
that's cool.
Sure.
You're a veteran. A veteran, we'll call you instead.
A regular guest.
There you go. Thank you. See, man, you should be hosting this with me. Before we jump into the book, would you mind starting us off with an excerpt?
Yeah, sure. I think what I'll do is I'll just read a little bit from the first chapter to kind of give you a sense of kind of what the book's about and what I'm trying to do with it. So I'll kind of skip around a little bit, but I'll start with the first section from the first chapter, which is called David's Leap.
Right.
On September 21st, 2012, 25-year-old David Villalobos purchased a pass for the Bronx Zoo and a $5 ticket for a ride on the Bengali Express monorail. The ride, built in 1977, promises on the zoo's website to take the visitor above mud wallows, pastures, forests, and riverbanks to the heart of wild Asia. After leaving the station, David would have first crossed the mud wallows of the Bronx River, a shallow and polluted urban waterway, before making his way quickly into said heart of wild Asia. And then I'm going to skip ahead a little bit to the sort of the moment of what David's doing there. David knew what was about to happen. The guide slowed the cars, trying to spot Ashuta in the brush, and pointing her out to the other visitors. David waited for his cue, for the opportunity. As his car pulled up alongside the tiger paddock, Villalobos suddenly stood up. He climbed up on the reaching up and bracing himself against the roof with his palms. He balanced briefly on the railing, rolling on the balls of his feet to get his balance right. Then he leaped, clearing four strands of barbed wire 16 feet down into the tiger's cage. And then I'm going to skip ahead a little bit more towards the end of this section. When David Villalobos jumped from the Bengali Express monorail into Bashuta's cage, he also leaped straight into my consciousness. Something about his story cracked open a well of curiosity that bordered on obsession. I followed all the initial news reports and the follow-up stories about the incidents. I couldn't get enough. I wanted all the information, all the facts and fluctuations, anything I could read about it. I wanted to get inside the story somehow. I'd heard of people leaping into cages with apex predators, but most of the time they don't survive to tell a story. David survived only to be vilified and mocked, publicly indicted as deranged and suicidal. But this story wasn't his story or the whole story. Aside from his statements to the responding officers and his boastful claim of landing like a cat, I could find few words from David himself. But his leap seemed to speak to me in ways that were hard to understand. It seemed too easy to write him off as crazy, Even retelling the story of his leap here seems ridiculous, even comical or absurd, like a tale I trot out at parties to get gasps or laughs. Who does such a thing? As is often the case, such questions become vessels for my own explorations. I wanted to understand the thinking of such savage and unruly minds. I wanted to get close to the subjectivity of people who push the boundaries between human and animal, who come close to crossing over. And I wanted to understand what drives someone like David Villalobos to make the leap, to thrust oneself into an encounter with an apex predator. What did he mean by calling it a spiritual thing? I wanted to understand what ecstasy exists, what promise of spiritual connection imbues such encounters, and how it can seduce someone to risking his life. But I guess I'm also trying to understand my own interest and compulsion to come close to this experience, my lifelong desire to inhabit these tales of survival in the face of animal savagery, as well as the larger pop culture embrace of these stories. Why do such stories persist, and why do we persist in loving them?
For your listeners, if you're just tuning in, that was Stephen Church. He's reading from his new book, One with the Tiger. Stephen, the book is, the whole book is just riveting. It's one of those that it's kind of a lot like, you know, how you're unable to look away from an accident or an act of violence. You know, you find yourself turning page after page and I was unable to put it down. And, you know, it kind of plays on our darker sensibilities in that way. But you actually include various stories. David Villalobos is kind of one of the main threads throughout the book, but there are several others that you kind of return to.
Yeah,
I guess one way to maybe contextualize the book also is on the back of the book here, it reads that this book, One with the Tiger, uses moments of violent encounters between humans and predators to explore the line between human and animal. What made you want to write this book?
You know, I mean, that's a good question, and it's sometimes hard for me to answer.
What possessed you?
I read the story of the initial story about David Villalobos. I read the news sort of obsessively pretty much every day, and so much of it is, you know, all the same stuff. And so it's when things like that, I look for headlines that jump out at me that seem interesting.
Right.
And, you know, every now and then I get sucked into some rabbit hole of research and sort of fall down into it.
Yeah.
And I think I was also kind of looking subconsciously, I guess, for a story that could kind of contain some of these ideas that I'd already been writing about.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd already written the piece about Mike Tyson and weird piece about severed ears.
Right, right.
And my kind of obsession with Mike Tyson and trying to, like, rationalize what he did to Evander Holyfield,
right,
which is admittedly a difficult project at times. But, and, you know, and I'd also written a piece about Ferdinand Bull, the bull, and the encounter that I had at a party.
Mm-hmm,
and so I think I was trying to, like, figure out what that was all about, you know, and I think somehow this story became a kind of a vessel that could maintain all those other ones. And it allowed me to write about, like, Timothy Treadwell, who I love as well.
Right. That's one of the things. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, and pop culture, you know, is sort of my jam. Like, I like to do that.
That's one of the things I really appreciated about this book is it's not, you know, you're not just sensationalizing these sort of, you know, horrific moments or, you know, these kind of terrifying moments where people have these encounters with animals, but you're actually in almost every paragraph or certainly every sentence even, you get the sense that the author, that you are digging to trying to find answers to your own questions. And of course, like you said, there was this incident at a party. And then you also talk about some of the interactions you have with friends, even watching sports or you guys are watching a boxing match. And so these moments of sort of male primalness or just, you know, that sort of come out in these situations and it's like you're trying to dig to find out what's that about and, you know, what is that line then between us and animal? And I mean, would that be a kind of an accurate description of what you're attempting to do here?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there's a lot of stories that, you know, have sort of jumped out at me and made me kind of trying to understand what that line is, I guess, for me, but then also how that line is represented in stories. I think the book is as much a book about stories.
Yeah, that's right.
About and the way we tell the stories and why we're obsessed with them. You know, why do we love these? But and I mean, I argue in the book that it's really kind of an archetypal story that goes all the way back to Daniel and the lion.
Right.
You know, these like tests of our faith, really, and then our spirituality and who we are as humans.
Absolutely. And you know,
it's a really old story. It's just now we hear him in the news and they get sensationalized and we think he's crazy. You know?
Right.
Well, maybe not.
No, right. It is absolutely. I agree with that. It's definitely also a look at stories and myth making even, you know.
Yeah.
You know, you talk about in here how Mike Tyson was sort of also a storyteller. He was able to weave and create this kind of narrative and this myth around boxing, not just himself, but around boxing even in general. And we were riveted by that. You know, can you talk a little bit about Mike Tyson as storyteller?
Well, you probably grew up around that same time.
I did, and there was
something about Tyson that was just undeniably compelling. You know, it's like we couldn't look away from him. You know, he's not necessarily a good person. He's done some really bad things, but he's also not an uninteresting person. You know, and for me, he's just everything he does and says, I find oddly compelling in some way. You know, there's something about him that we latched onto, and I think there's something very real about him. Very, very frightening. You know, I think like we were a bunch of like middle class white kids in Kansas, you know, gathered around watching Tyson, and we were just nuts for this guy. And part of what I'm trying to figure out is what is that about? You know, what is it? And then how did that flip switch? You know, when he bit off Evander Holyfield's ear, it's like all of a sudden Tyson was an animal.
Yeah, he crossed over.
Whereas up to that point, we're like, Tyson is the best ever.
And then
at some point, he went too far for us.
And funny you mentioned you were a bunch of middle class white kids in Kansas, and you know when I was watching that fight, we were a bunch of middle class Chicanos in Fresno, and it was like we had the same exact response to it. But you know, certainly at least in my own experiences, you know, we knew many people, many men and guys who've gotten in fights and bit people. You know, it was like that was normal. Yeah. You bite people. You know, you punch and scratch. Yeah. You bite people when you fight.
I went to high school and got in a fight with someone who bit his finger off.
See, that's what I mean. He's like, you know, and yet when we saw that on TV or in this boxing match, and of course we're all hailing up until that time, we've all sort of, or at least those who watch Tyson fights were sort of, you know, we wanted to see that bloodshed in the ring. We wanted to see that. And then yet when he bites an ear off, we're suddenly almost, you know, shocked by that, you know? It's interesting.
And I think Tyson was a performer. He is a performer. I mean, I talk about him in the book. Famous interview where he says he wants to eat Lennox Lewis's children, and people are like, "Oh my God, he's crazy!"
Yeah.
But you could see in that interview. I mean, what you don't know is the backstory of that interview is that one of his dear friends from childhood had just died, and you could see the switch flip in the interview. Like at first, he's sort of just kind of talking about this friend, and then all of a sudden, the switch flips and he starts comparing himself to all these great fighters, and then he praises Allah and threatens to eat Lennox Lewis's children, and everyone's like, "Oh my God!"
Yeah,
I thought it was great. You know,
he was weaving.
I guess I also, you know, we grew up in the age of professional wrestling too, where like some of that performance was very attractive. You know,
And then another story weaver, you know, that you bring up to is Timothy Treadwell, or at least, Timothy Treadwell himself, but then even Werner Herzog, who does the documentary Grizzly Man about Treadwell, how certainly Herzog's view of Treadwell also becomes a different sort of version or of that story. Can you talk a little bit about Timothy Treadwell then and how, you know, his story informed some of the book itself here?
Yeah, you know, Treadwell was somebody who, I mean, I've been kind of obsessed or interested with for quite a while, ever since the Herzog film. And I heard the story, of course, before, and I'd seen the film. And it's a supremely weird and awesome movie in a lot of ways. And it's sort of, there's like, I'm not sure there's somebody who more unlike Timothy Treadwell than Werner Herzog. You know, Treadwell is this sort of, you know, idealistic, I mean, I call him a charismatic barbarian. I mean, I even compare him to Tyson at one point. They both had these sort of oversized personalities. They both talked in this kind of high-pitched voice, almost childlike at times.
Right.
And, you know, Herzog is this very unsympathetic, very, very German, and notoriously, you know, has this view of the animal world as it being completely unsympathetic and uncaring because, cares nothing for humans. It's nothing but violence and murder. And, you know, it's sort of the oddest combination of storytellers there. And the result in the film is really, I think it's a wonderful film. It's a strange film, you know, filled with like lots of variations of the truth, I guess, or reality some way, which I think is interesting.
Right. So there's a section in this book, Stephen, where you talk about Treadwell and you also talk about Werner Herzog and his take on Treadwell. Would you mind reading that excerpt for us?
Sure.
All right.
Yeah. So this starts on page 75. One of the more powerful scenes in Grizzly Man finds Herzog himself sitting in front of Treadwell's longtime friend and former girlfriend, Jewel. The camera peers over Herzog's shoulder, revealing only a thin profile of his face at the edge of the image, and focuses its objective gaze on Jewel's face as she watches Herzog listen to the recording of the attack with a pair of large headphones. In a documentary film, there's something very odd about this choice. It is clearly not cinema verite, where the camera functions as an impassive, objective fly on the wall, but instead a film where our narrator is also the director and the character, a witness to things that we cannot access through the film. The movie offers up Herzog as a surrogate for our morbid curiosity, a vessel for the violence and horror. We watch Jewel watch him listening in an intoxicating loop of subjective, mediated witness. Herzog tells her that he can hear Treadwell yelling at Amy to run away, to get away. He's screaming at her to run. Herzog puts his hand up to his face. Jewel gasps, and in the silence, my mind fills the gaps left in the story. Just barely approaching something close to the experience. I can't quite get all the way there with my imagination. It's too much, too hard to contain, perhaps too real. There is no other sound during the scene in the film. All you're given is the silence of Herzog listening to Treadwell's death.
Yes.
When he hands the headphones back to Jewel and tells her she must never listen to the tape and never look at the autopsy photos, he tells her the tape will be the white elephant in the room all your life.
Yeah, and it becomes the white elephant in our heads, you know, for as long as we hear that narrative, you know. And that is the most compelling part of that entire, for me, of that entire documentary, that unseen, unheard of factor. And we teach that even to writing students, don't we? I mean, that idea of, you know, can you talk a little bit about that? Because that to me was really compelling, what we didn't see, what we didn't hear, and what we believe to be true.
Well, I mean, I'm a nonfiction nerd and an essay nerd. And to me, as I was reading that, I realized, like, what I'm saying is essentially Herzog is an essayist. You know, he's performing as the author, the narrator, and a character in this film. So it's very essayistic in that way.
Yeah.
And he becomes, I mean, what I say at the end of the section is I realized that what I didn't want in that scene, and I don't think I realized it until, you know, I'd seen the movie, but what I didn't want is something like the opening scene in The Revenant, which is a fantastic scene, don't get me wrong, I write about that as well, but there's some, like, Herzog did not recreate the scene of Treadwell's death, you know, in a way that you might fictionally or something, you know, he didn't have actors and he didn't do some sort of special effects. Instead, we watch him listening to the attack, which is, to me, this weird, you know, these layers of mediation between you and the experience, but somehow makes it more terrifying?
Yes, absolutely. Well, we don't see it. Right, because, you know, in a documentary, typically the go-to would have been to create a sort of reenactment of what took place or something. And he doesn't do that. He actually, I mean, that I think was kind of the stroke of storytelling genius at that point, was just Herzog sort of coming, stepping out from behind the camera and even starting, you know, narrating to us what we're not hearing. So suddenly we want to know what that sounds like, what that was, what happened, what took place. And then at the end, he sort of puts an exclamation point on us by telling us it's going to be the white elephant, you know, in your life.
The white elephant in the room. The white elephant, would be like a gift that you don't want, but that's always there.
God, I know. And that's exactly
what it is. I mean, I don't have any background in filmmaking, but you get the sense that, like, if somebody in a filmmaking class told you to do that, the professor would be like, no.
Yeah, exactly.
That's not what we do.
That's not what we do here. No, exactly.
Yeah, Herzog, like, I don't care about any of that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's what made that part really compelling. If you're just tuning in, for our listeners, we are speaking with the author, Stephen Church, about his wonderful and fascinating new nonfiction book, One with the Tiger. It's out with Soft Skull Press. It's remarkable. You got to pick it up. So, Stephen, getting back to actually one of the main stories in this throughout this book, David Villa-Lobos, you know, I'm curious to know, what were you feeling when, because you actually went to the zoo to retrace his steps, with the exception of jumping into the cage, you know, but what were you sort of feeling physically as you were retracing his steps there?
You know, it's interesting. That was a really important, ended up being a very important trip for me in the book. I mean, in some ways it failed because I couldn't get anybody to talk to me about it. But what that trip ended up being was what I think of as kind of the spine through the whole book. Like, I keep coming back to that that trip to the zoo. And, you know, so it provides a kind of narrative spine for me, a kind of present action. And it really, like, before I had that, the book felt a lot less sort of unified, you know, and felt like more like a collection of disparate pieces. And so that trip really kind of helped sort of pull everything into the same orbit, I guess. Right. And then just to be in that space where he had been was really important, I think, for me, to just to see what it looked like, you know, and be able to, like, ride on the same tram. And, like, I took the trip a couple of times and, you know, was just sort of, I could get into that space, you know, so I could talk about what the tram looks like, you know, and not just purely out of my imagination, though, of course, there's a lot of that, too.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it was good. Like I said, the physical space of that story, I think, was more important to me than I think I realized at the time.
Right. And then there's this really interesting exchange you have with one of the zoo workers there who she's like one of the guide tour guides or something. And she's like, because you're asking her questions and she's trying to, she's telling you she can't talk about that incident. And
she's just eating a sandwich and I'm like trying to talk to her about it.
Yeah.
And she just won't talk to me.
Yeah.
She's just straight up like, no, I can't talk about it.
Yeah. And then later on she sees you again and then she's like, you make me nervous. Or what does she say? I'm scared of you.
You scare me.
That's right.
At the time, I thought she thought that I was going to, that I was a, because she said, well, we get paparazzi who come in here and they want to, like, to dig up the story. And I'm like, I'm not a paparazzi. I don't, you know, I didn't even have a camera or anything. But then I realized, I think she thought I was going to jump.
Right. Yeah. No, and then later on.
I wasn't there for that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Nope, not me. And then you also mentioned the movie with Leonardo DiCaprio that recently came out. I think it's The Revenant. Is that what it's called?
Yeah, I haven't seen that yet,
but I know that you know, it was widely popular and it's about this real, based on this real man. But one of the interesting things that you mentioned there is that you talk about how Leonardo DiCaprio is a method actor and how, you know, he basically puts himself in these situations just to prepare for this role. And, you know, I've actually used this idea before, too, in talking with students or talking about researching a book, you know, this idea of method writing, you know. But can you talk a little bit about what that means for you in regards to this book?
Well, I don't know much about method acting except from what I've read and heard. But, you know, the idea is sort of, I guess, sort of back to what you said before about putting yourself into that physical reality of a character in some ways to some greater or lesser extremes. I mean, the stories of what some method actors do seems to me kind of nuts where, you know, they never break character. But I think that the idea behind it, right, is of living with those characters inside your head in a very real way so that they become, I mean, as an actor, you become them.
Right.
You know, I think as a writer, it's that idea of, I mean, a similar idea, I suppose, you know, that you become them in some way, or you internalize that experience, that physical reality of it.
Right.
I mean, I didn't go so far, obviously, as to be attacked by an animal, but thought about it.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I wonder what that would be like.
Maybe by a cat. Maybe I'll go out there and, you know,
like
wrestle my cat.
Maybe a bobcat.
Yeah.
I could probably take a bobcat.
Bobcat with a full body suit, though, you know?
Right,
like,
Something like that. Maybe declawed.
Yeah, declawed. A declawed bobcat.
But, man. But that scene was, you know, in The Revenant is. You just watch the first scene and then skip the rest.
You know,
it's just like the rest of it's just a lot of grunting and suffering.
But,
you know, it's a really amazing opening scene if you're at all compelled by like those kinds of
stories. Obviously, I couldn't put your book down, you know, but You know, one of the things, too, is, I mean, but what we try and do as writers of these kinds of subjects is to get as close to method acting as we can, or as close, basically as close to the subject and to the experience that we possibly can without injuring ourselves, of course, you know, but.
Well,
you know,
I mean, I remember you talking to me about, you know, when you were working on your book and how, this just stuck with me, and you talked about how you found an airplane, you know, that was roughly this, or was maybe the same aircraft, and just spend time sitting in the space of that airplane. And that, to me, I don't know, it stuck with me. You know, I thought, like, that's important. You know, and I think, you know, in MFA programs where I teach, and I mean, I think it's hard for students to be able to do that at times. And I feel like I'm constantly trying to push them to get outside of the comfort zones of the academy and the classroom.
And the desk. Get out of the
desk.
Yeah,
and the desk. Right. Absolutely.
Yeah, that's one thing. You know, the only, and that was, absolutely. That was one of the things I did to write the plane crash scene was to obviously research as much around it as I could. And then to actually finally sit in, after all the research, sit inside of an actual DC-3 airplane and write the plane crash from inside of it. But the only thing I didn't, because someone asked me recently, as one of the audiences I was reading to, they said, now, did you go as far as skydiving? I was like, oh my gosh. No, I didn't. And, you know, I'm glad I didn't think of it because I might have, you know.
That's the method writing there, right?
Yeah, no, man. But, you know, we got to get as close as possible to the story, I agree. So.
Yeah.
And then later on you talk about, one of the questions I wanted to ask you, because we only have a few minutes left here, is do you find it difficult to write? Because a lot of the book, you're being very candid and, you know, honest about your own sort of, you know, growing up and process as a coming of age, a man coming of age, and just, you know, your own psychology. Do you find it difficult to write so open and honest about yourself?
Not really. That's sort of, you know, it's kind of what I do. I mean, that's kind of what I've been doing right. for a while. I mean, honestly, this book for me is, I mean, although there's a lot of very personal stuff in here, I realize even, you know, contested some things that I never have before. You know, to me, the book isn't so much about that stuff as sort of kind of right. all the other stuff around it. You know, like there's always things that are fueling my writing, and often it's the same stuff or similar questions. And then I'm really interested in where those questions lead me sort of outside of myself. Right. I mean, I talk about, my friend talks about everybody has a secret engine that fuels whatever it is they're working on. And I mean, right. depending on the project, that might change. But, you know, you could be writing a shopping list and right. that secret engine would somehow fuel that. And, you know, I like to push it a little further and say, like, sometimes, you know, you don't even have to lift the hood and look at the engine to know that it's running. You know, it's always churning. No matter. So if I'm writing about a crappy, you know, 80s television show, you know, underneath all that is some of this angst of growing up in the 80s and my parents' divorce and, you know, nuclear fear and, like, all that other stuff that was going on at the time.
Well, we've run out of time now, my friend, and I want to let our listeners know that we have been speaking with the author, Stephen Church, author and editor, because I know you also edit The Normal School, which is a well-known literary journal as well. And hopefully that's going great for you guys. But we're speaking with author Stephen Church about his latest nonfiction book called One with the Tiger. It's using moments of violent encounters between humans and predators to explore the line between human and animal. So you want to check it out. It's a great book. Stephen, thank you so much for being with us on the show.
Thanks, Tim. It was great talking to you, man.
Absolutely. Likewise. We'd like to thank our guest today, the one and only Stephen Church, with his new book, One with a Tiger. It's out with Soft Skull. You want to be sure to pick that up. You won't be disappointed. That wraps it up for this edition of Words on a Wire. I'd like to thank our wonderful producer, Kimberly Garcia, behind the boards there. And I am Tim Hernandez. We'll see you next week, same time, same place on KTEP 88.5 FM.